This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Pirate Story.
You're tuned to KBOO Portland. Stay tuned for Gremlin Time, the bedtime story program for grown-ups. You are entering a zone of sound and imagery. A landscape of frequency. A vocabulary of modulation. There is the signpost up ahead. Please adjust your chronometers. This is Gremlin Time.
Good evening, this is Fortunato. Tonight we're featuring Raphael Sabatini. He wrote lots of historic adventure novels and short stories. For tonight, we're going to present a real pirate story, The Treasure Ship by Raphael Sabatini. It was a saying of Captain Blood's that the worth of a man manifests itself not so much in the ability to plan great undertakings as in the vision which perceives opportunity and the address which he knows how to seize it. He had certainly displayed these qualities in possessing himself of that fine Spanish ship, the Cinco Llagas, and he had displayed them again in foiling the designs of that rascally buccaneer, Captain Easterling, to rob him of that noble vessel. Meanwhile, his own and his ship's near escape made it clear to all who followed him that there was little safety for them in Tortuga waters, and little trust to be placed in buccaneers. At a general council held that same afternoon in the ship's waist, Blood propounded the simple philosophy that when a man is attacked, he must either fight or run. And since we are in no case to fight when attacked, as no doubt we shall be, it but remains to play the coward's part, if only to prove ourselves brave men some other day. They agreed with him, but whilst the decision to run was taken, it was left to be determined later whither they should repair. At the moment, all that mattered was to get away from Tortuga and the further probable attentions of Captain Easterling. Thus it fell out that in the dead of the following night, which if clear was moonless, the great frigate, which once had been the pride of the Cadiz shipyards, weighed anchors quietly as such an operation might be performed, with canvas spread to the faint favoring breeze from the shore, and with the ebb tide to help the maneuver, the Cinco Llagas stood out to sea. With groan of windlass, rattle of chain, and creak of blocks had betrayed the action to Easterling aboard the Bonaventure, a cable's length away. It was not in Easterling's power to thwart Blood's intention. At least three quarters of his rascally crew were in the taverns ashore, and Easterling was not disposed to attempt boarding operations with the remnant of his men, even though that remnant outnumbered by 2-1 the hands of the Cinco Llagas. Moreover, even had his full complement of 200 been aboard, Easterling would still have offered no opposition to that departure. Whilst in Tortuga waters, he might have attempted to get possession of the Cinco Llagas quietly and by strategy. Not even his recklessness could consider seizing her violently by force in such a sanctuary, especially as the French governor, Monsieur de Ogeron, appeared to be friendly disposed towards Blood and his fellow fugitives. Out on the open sea, it would be another matter, and the tale he would afterwards tell of the manner in which the Cinco Llagas should have come into his possession would be such as no one in the Caribbean would be in a position to contradict. So Captain Easterling suffered Peter Blood to depart unhindered, and was well content to let him go. Nor did he display any undue and betraying haste to follow. He made his preparations with leisureliness and did not weigh anchor until the afternoon of the morrow. He trusted his wits to give him the direction Blood must take, and depended upon the greater speed of the Bonaventure to overhaul him before he should have gone far enough for safety. His reasoning was shrewd enough, since he knew that the Cinco Llagas was not viticled for a long voyage. There could be no question yet of any direct attempt to sail for Europe. First, she must be equipped, and since to equip her Blood dared approach no English or Spanish settlement, it followed that he would steer for one of the neutral Dutch colonies and there take his only remaining chance. Nor was Blood likely without experienced pilotage to venture among the dangerous reefs of the Bahamas. It was therefore an easy inference that his destination would be the Leeward Islands, with intent to put in at San Martin, Saba, or Santa Eustacia. Confident then of overtaking him before he could make the nearest of those Dutch settlements 200 leagues away, the pursuing Bonaventure steered an easterly course along the northern shores of Hispaniola. Things, however, were not destined to be so simple as easterling conjecture. The wind, at first favorable, veered towards evening to the east, and increased throughout the night in vehemence, so that by dawn, an angry dawn, the skies ominously flushed, the Bonaventure had not merely made no progress, but had actually drifted some miles out of her course. Then the wind shifted to the south towards noon, and it came on to blow harder than ever. It blew up a storm from the Caribbean, and for 24 hours the Bonaventure rode it out with bare yards and hatches battered against the pounding seas that broke athwart her and tossed her like a cork from trough to crest. It was fortunate that the burly Captain Easterling was not only a stout fighter, but also an able seaman. Under his skilled handling, the Bonaventure came through the ordeal unscathed to resume the chase when at last the storm had passed and the wind had settled to a steady breeze from the southwest. With crowded canvas, the sloop now went scudding through the heavy seas that the storm had left. Easterling heartened his followers with the reminder that the hurricane which had delayed them must no less have delayed the Cinco Llagas, that indeed, considering the landlubbers who handled the erstwhile Spanish frigate, it was likely that the storm had made things easier for the Bonaventure. What exactly the storm had done for them they were to discover on the following morning, when, off Cape Engano, they sighted a galleon, which at first, in the distance, they supposed to be their quarry, but which very soon they perceived to be some other vessel. That she was Spanish was advertised not only by her towering built, but by the banner of Castile, which she flew beneath the crucifix at the head of her mainmast. On the yards of this mainmast, all canvas was close-reefed, and under the spread of only foresail, mizzen, and spirit, she was laboring clumsily towards the Mona Passage with the wind on her larboard quarter. The sight of her particularly maimed condition stirred Easterling like a hound at the sight of a deer. For the moment, the quest of the Cinco Llagas was forgotten. Here was more immediate prey, and of a kind to be easily reduced. At the poop rail, he brawled his orders rapidly. In obedience, the decks were cleared with feverish speed, and the netting spread from stem to stern to catch any spars that might be shot down in the approaching action. Charred, Easterling's lieutenant, a short, powerful man, was a dullard in all things save the handling of a ship, and the wielding of a cutlass, took the helm. The gunners at their stations cleared the leaden aprons from the touch holes and swung their glowing matches ready for the word of command. For however disorderly and unruly Easterling's crew might be at ordinary times, it knew the need for discipline when battle was to be joined.
Fire!
Watchful on the poop, the buccaneer captain surveyed the Spaniard upon which he was rapidly bearing down, and observed with scorn the scurry of preparation on her decks. His practiced eye read her immediate past history at a glance, and his harsh, guttural voice announced what he read to Chard, who stood below him at the whipstaff.
She would be homing for Spain, the hurricane caught her. She sprung her main mast and had likely suffered other damage besides. She's beaten back to San Domingo for repairs.
Easterling laughed in his throat and stroked his dense black beard. The dark, bold eyes in his great red face glinted wickedly.
Give me a home in Spaniard, Jard. There'll be treasure aboard that hulk, by God. We're in luck at last.
He was indeed. It had long been his grievance, and the true reason of his coveting the Cinco Llagas, that his sloop, the Bonaventure, was unequal to tackling the real prizes of the Caribbean. And he would never have dared to attack this heavily armed galleon, but that in her crippled condition, she was unable to maneuver so as to bring her guns to bear upon his flanks. She gave him now a broadside from her starboard quarter, and by doing so, sealed her own doom. The Bonaventure, coming head-on, presented little target, and save for a round shot in her forecastle, took no damage. Easterling answered the fire with the chasers on his prow, aiming high and sweeping the Spaniard's decks. Then, nimbly avoiding her clumsy attempt to go about and change their relative positions, the Bonaventure was alongside on the quarter of her empty guns. There was a rattling, thudding jar, a creak of entangling rigging, a crack and a clatter of broken spars, and the thud of grapples rending into the Spaniard's timbers to bind her fast, and then tight-locked. The two vessels went drifting downwind, whilst the buccaneers, led by the colossal Easterling, and after discharging a volley of musketry, swarmed like ants over the Spaniards' bulwarks. 200 of them there were, fierce fellows in loose leather breeches, some with shirts as well, but the majority naked to the waist, and by that brown muscular nakedness, the more terrific of aspect. To receive them stood a bare 50 Spaniards in corselet and morion, drawn up in the galleon's waist as if upon parade, with muskets calmly leveled and a hawk-faced officer in a plumed hat commanding them. The officer spoke an order, and a volley from the muskets momentarily checked the assault. Then, like an engulfing wave, the buccaneer mob went over the Spanish soldiers, and the ship, the Santa Barbara, was taken. There was not, perhaps, upon the seas at the time a more cruel and ruthless man than Easterling. Those who sailed with him adopted, as men will, their captain's standard of ferocity. Brutally, they exterminated the Spanish soldiery, heaving the bodies overboard, and as brutally they dealt with those manning the guns on the main deck below. Although these unfortunates readily surrendered in the vain hope of being allowed to keep their lives. Within 10 minutes of the invasion of the Santa Barbara, there remained alive upon her, of her original crew, only the captain, Don Ildefonso de Pravia, whom Easterling had stunned with the butt of a pistol, the navigating officer, and 4 deckhands who had been aloft at the moment of boarding. These 6 Easterling spared for the present, because he accounted that they might prove useful. Whilst his men were busy in the shrouds about the urgent business of disentangling and, where necessary, repairing, the buccaneer captain began upon the person of Don Ildefonso the investigation of his capture. The Spaniard, sickly and pallid, and with a lump on his brow where the pistol butt had smitten him, sat on a locker in the handsome, roomy cabin with pinioned wrists, but striving nevertheless to preserve the haughty demeanor proper to a gentleman of Castile. Thus, until Easterling, towering over him, savagely threatened to loosen his tongue by the artless persuasions of torture. Then Don Ildefonso, realizing the futility of resistance, curtly answered the pirate's questions. In these answers and the subsequent investigations, Easterling discovered his capture to exceed every hope he could have formed. There had fallen into his hands, which of late had known so little luck, one of those prizes which had been the dream of every sea rover since the days of Francis Drake. The Santa Barbara was a treasure ship from Portobello, laden with gold and silver which had been conveyed across the isthmus from Panama. She had put forth under the escort of three strong ships of war, with intent to call at San Domingo to revitical before crossing to Spain. But in the recent storm which had swept the Caribbean, she had been separated from her consorts and with damaged mainmast had been driven through the Mona Passage by the gale. She had been beating back for San Domingo in the hope of rejoining there her consort or else awaiting there another fleet for Spain. The treasure in her hold was computed by Easterling when his gleaming eyes came to consider those ingots at between 200,000 and 300,000 pieces of eight. It was a prize such as does not come the way of a pirate twice in his career, and it meant fortune for himself and those who sailed with him. Now, the possession of fortune is inevitably attended by anxiety. And Easterling's besetting anxiety at the moment was to convey his prize with all possible speed to the security of Tortuga. From his own sloop, he took 20 men to form a prize crew for the Spaniard, and himself remained aboard her because he could not suffer himself to be parted from the treasure. Then, with damage hurriedly repaired, the two ships went about and started upon their voyage. Progress was slow, the wind being none too favorable, and the Santa Barbara none too manageable, and it was past noon before they had Cape Raphael once more abeam. Easterling was uneasy in this near proximity to Hispaniola, and was for taking a wide sweep that would carry them well out to sea, when, from the crow's nest of the Santa Barbara, came a hail, and a moment later, the object first espied by the lookout was visible to them all. There, rounding Cape Raphael, not 2 miles away, and steering almost to meet them, came a great red ship under full sail. Easterling's telescope confirmed at once what the naked eye had led him incredulously to suspect. This vessel was the Cinco Llagas, the original object of his pursuit, which in his haste he must have outsailed. The truth was that overtaken by the storm as they approached Samana, Jeremy Pitt, who navigated the Cinco Llagas, had run for the shelter of Samana Bay, and under the lee of a headland, had remained snug and unperceived, to come forth again when the gale had spent itself. Easterling, caring little how the thing had happened, perceived in this sudden and unexpected appearance of the Cinco Llagas a sign that fortune, hitherto so niggardly, was disposed now to overwhelm him with her favors. Lent him convey himself and the Santa Barbara's treasure aboard that stout red ship, and in strength he could make good speed home. Against a vessel so heavily armed and so undermanned as the Cinco Llagas, there could be no question of any but boarding tactics, and it did not seem to Captain Easterling that this should offer much difficulty to the swifter and more easily handled Bonaventure, commanded by a man experienced in seamanship and opposed by a landlubberly follower who was by trade a mere surgeon. So, Easterling signaled Chard to be about the easy business, and Chard, eager enough to square accounts with the man who once already had done them the injury of slipping like water through their fingers, put the helm over and ordered his men to their stations. Captain Blood, summoned from the cabin by Pitt, mounted the poop deck and telescope in hand, surveyed the activities aboard his old friend, the Bonaventure. He remained in no doubt of their significance. He might be a surgeon, but hardly a landlubberly one, as Chard so rashly judged him. His service under Admiral De Ruyter in those earlier adventurous days when medicine was neglected by him had taught him more fighting tactics than Easterling had ever known. He would show these pirates how he had profited by the lessons learnt under that great admiral. Just as for the Bonaventure, it was essential to employ boarding tactics, so for the Cinco Llagas, it was vital to depend on gunfire. For with no more than 20 men in all, she could not face the odds of almost 10-1, as Blood computed them, of a hand-to-hand engagement. So now he ordered Pitt to put down the helm, and, keeping as close to the wind as possible, to steer a course that would bring them on to the Bonaventure's quarter. To the main deck below, he ordered Ogley, that sometime gunner of the King's Navy, taking for his gun crew all but 6 of the hands who would be required for work above. Chard perceived at once the aim of the maneuver and swore through his teeth, for Blood had the weather gauge of him. He was further handicapped by the fact that, since the Centellagos was to be captured for their own purposes, it must be no part of his work to cripple her by gunfire before attempting to board. Moreover, he perceived the risk to himself of the attempt, resulting from the longer range and heavier caliber of the guns of the Cinco Llagas if she were resolutely handled, and there appeared to be no lack of resolution about her present master. Meanwhile, the distance between the ships was rapidly lessening, and Chard realized that unless he acted quickly, he would be within range with his flank exposed. Unable to bring his ship any closer to the wind, he went about on a southeasterly course with intent to circle widely and so get to windward of the Cinco Llagas. Easterling, watching the maneuver from the deck of the Santa Barbara and not quite understanding its purpose, cursed Chard for a fool. Cursed himself the more virulently when he saw the Cinco Llagas veer suddenly to larboard and follow as if giving chase. Chard, however, welcomed this and, taking in sail, allowed the other to draw closer. Then, with all canvas spread once more, the Bonaventure was off with the wind down her quarter to attempt her circling movement. Blood understood and took in sail in his turn, standing so that as the Bonaventure turned north, she must offer him her flank within range of his heavy guns. Hence Char, to avoid this, must put up his helm and run south once more. Easterling, watching the two ships sailing away from him in a succession of such maneuvers for position, in purple with rage, demanded of heaven and hell whether he could believe his eyes, which told him only that Chard was running away from the lubberly leech. Chard, however, was far from any such intention. With masterly patience and self-control, he awaited his chance to run in and grapple. And, with equal patience and doggedness, Blood saw to it that he should be given no such chance. You're listening to The Treasure Ship, a pirate story by Raphael Sabatini, featuring Captain Peter Blood. This is Gremlin Time. I am Fortunato. We'll be back after this.
Oh, better far to live and die under the brave black flag I fly than play a sanctimonious part with a pirate head and a pirate heart. Away to the cheating world go you, where pirates all are well-to-do, but I'll be true to the song I sing and live and die a pirate king. For I am a pirate king, and
And it is a glorious thing to be a pirate king. For I am a pirate king. And it is a glorious thing to be a pirate king.
It is for love of the pirate king, for love of the pirate king.
When I sally forth to seek my prey, I help myself in a royal way. I sink a few more ships, it's true, than a well-bred monarch ought to do. But many a king on a first-class throne, if he wants to call his crown his own, must manage somehow to get through more dirty work than ever I do. For I am a pirate king, and it is a glorious thing to be a pirate king. For I am a pirate king. And it is a glorious thing to be a pirate king.
It is for all the pirate king, for all the pirate king.
You're listening to Community Radio for the Northwest, KBOO Portland.
We return now to our pirate adventure featuring Captain Blood. The Treasure Ship by Raphael Sabatini. In the end, it became a question of who should commit the first blunder. And it was Chard who committed it. In his almost excessive anxiety to avoid coming broadside on with the Cintoliagas, he forgot the chasers on her peakhead, and at last, in playing for position, allowed her to come too near. He realized his blunder. When these two guns roared suddenly behind him, and the shot went tearing through his shrouds, it angered him. And in his anger, he replied with his stern chasers. But their inferior caliber left their fire ineffective. Then, utterly enraged, he swung the Bonaventure about so as to put a broadside athwart the hawser of the other, and by crippling her sailing powers, lay her at the mercy of his boarders. The heavy ground swell, however, combined with the length of the range utterly to defeat his object, and his broadside thundered forth in impotence to leave a cloud of smoke between himself and the Cincoliagas. Instantly, Blood swung broadside on and emptied his 20 larboard guns into that smoke cloud, hoping to attain the Bonaventure's exposed flank beyond. The attempt was equally unsuccessful, but it served to show Chard the mettle of the man he was engaging, a man with whom it was not safe to take such chances. Nevertheless, one more chance he took and went briskly about so as to charge through the billowing smoke and so bear down upon the other ship before she could suspect the design. The maneuver, however, was too protracted for success. By the time the Bonaventure was upon her fresh course, the smoke had dispersed sufficiently to betray her tactics to Blood, and the Cincoliagas, laying well over to larboard, was ripping through the water at twice the speed of the Bonaventure, now ill-served by the wind. Again, Chard put the helm over and raced to intercept the other and to get to windward of her. But Blood, now a mile away and with a safety margin of time, went about and returned so as to bring his starboard guns to bear at the proper moment. To elude this, Chard once more headed south and presented no more than his counter as a target. In this manner, the two vessels worked gradually away until the Santa Barbara, with the raging, blaspheming easterling aboard, was no more than a speck on the northern horizon, and still they were as far as ever from joining battle. Chard cursed the wind which favored Captain Blood, and cursed Captain Blood, who knew so well how to take and maintain the advantage of his position. A lubberly surgeon appeared possessed of perfect understanding of the situation and uncannily ready to meet each move of his opponent. Occasional shots continued to be exchanged by the chasers of each vessel, each aiming high so as to damage the other's sailing powers, yet with the long range separating them without success. Peter Blood at the poop rail, in a fine back and breast and a cap of black steel, which had been the property of the original Spanish commander of the Cinco Llagas, was growing weary and anxious. To Hagthorne, similarly armed himself, to Wolverstone, whom no armor aboard would fit, and to Pitt at the whipstaff immediately below, he confessed it in the tone of his question, "How long can this ducking and dodging continue? And however long it continues, what end can it have but one? Sooner or later, the wind will drop or veer, or else it's ourselves will drop from sheer weariness. When that happens, we'll be at that scoundrel's mercy."
"There's always the unexpected,"
said young Pitt.
"Why, so there is, and I thank you for reminding me of it, Jerry. Let's put our hopes in it. For all that, I can't see whence it's to come."
He was coming at that moment, and coming quickly, although Blood was the only one of them who recognized it when he saw it. They were standing in towards the land at the end of a long westerly run, and round the point of Espada, less than a mile away, a towering, heavily armed ship came sailing as close to the wind as she dared, her ports open, and the mouths of a score of guns gaping along her larboard flank, the banner of Castile flapping aloft in the breeze. At sight of this fresh enemy of another sort, Wolverstone loosened an oath that sounded like a groan.
"And that's the end of us,"
he cried.
"Am by no means sure now that it may not be the beginning,"
Blood answered him with something that sounded like laughter in his voice, which, when last heard, had been jaded and dispirited. And his orders, flowing fast, showed clearly what was in his mind. "Run me up the flag of Spain aloft, and bid Ogley empty his chasers at the Bonaventure as we go about." As Pitt put the helm over, and, with straining cordage and creaking blocks, the Cinco Llagas swung slowly round, the gold and scarlet banner of Castile broke bravely from her main trunk. An instant later, the two guns on her forecastle thundered forth, ineffectually in one way, but very effectual in another. Their fire conveyed very plainly to the Spanish newcomer that here he beheld a compatriot ship in pursuit of an English rover. Explanations no doubt must follow, especially if upon the discovery of the identity of the Cinco Llagas, the Spaniard should happen to be already acquainted with her recent history. But that could not come until they had disposed of the Bonaventure, and Blood was more than content to let the future take care of itself. Meanwhile, the Spanish ship, the Guarda Costa from San Domingo, which, whilst on patrol, had been attracted beyond the point of Espada by the sound of gunfire out at sea, behaved precisely as was to be expected. Even without the flag now floating at her masthead, the Spanish origin of the Cinco Llagas was plain to read in the lines of her. That she was engaged with this equally obvious English sloop was no less plain. The Guarda Costa went into the fight without a moment's hesitation and loosened a broadside at the Bonaventure as she was in the act of going about to escape this sudden and unforeseen peril. Chard raged like a madman as the sloop shuddered under blows at stem and stern, and her shattered bowsprit hung in a tangle of cordage athwart her bows. In his frenzy, he ordered the fire to be returned and did some damage to the Guarda Costa, but not of a kind to impair her mobility. The Spaniard, warming to the battle, went about so as to pound the sloop with her starboard guns, and Chard, having lost his head by now, swung round also so as to return or even anticipate that fire. Not until he had done so did it occur to him that with empty guns he was helplessly vulnerable to an onslaught from the Cinco Llagas.
For Blood, too, espying the opportunity whilst yet it was shaping, had gone about, drawn level, and hurled at him the contents of his heavy artillery. A broadside at comparatively short range swept his deck, shattered the windows of the coach, and one well-placed shot opened a wound in the bows of the Bonaventure, almost on the waterline, through which the sea rushed into the hold at every roll of the crippled vessel. Chard realized that he was doomed, and his bitterness was deepened by misapprehension at the root of his destruction. He saw the Spanish flag at the masthead of the Cinco de August and grinned in livid malice. On a last inspiration, he struck his colors in token of surrender. It was his forlorn hope that the Garda Costa, accepting this, and ignorant of his strength in men, would rush in to grapple him, in which case he would turn the tables on the Spaniards, and possessing himself of the Garda Costa, might yet come out of the adventure with safety and credit. But the vigilant Captain Blood guessed, if not the intention, at least the possibility, as well as the alternative possibility of explanations dangerous to himself, from the captured Chard to the Spanish commander. To provide against either danger, he sent for Oglie, and under his instructions, that skillful gunner crashed a 32-pound shot into the Bonaventure's waterline amidships, so as to supplement the leakage already occurring forward. The captain of the Garda Costa may have wondered why his compatriot should continue to fire upon a ship that had struck her colors, but the circumstance would hardly seem to him suspicious, although it might be vexatious, for its consequence appeared to be the inevitable destruction of a vessel which might have yet been turned to account. As for Chard, he had no time for speculations of any kind. The Bonaventure was now making water so fast that his only hope of saving the lives of himself and his men lay in attempting to run her aground before she sank. So he headed her for the shoals at the foot of the Point of Espada, thanking God that she might now run before the wind, although at an ominously diminishing speed, despite the fact that the buccaneers heaved their cannon overboard to lighten her as she went. She grounded at last in the shallows, with the seas breaking over her stern and forecastles, which alone remained above water. These and the shrouds were now black with the man who had climbed to safety. The Garda Costa stood off with idly flapping sails, waiting. Her captain, wondering to behold the Cinco de August, half a mile away already, heading northwards. Aboard her presently, Captain Blood was inquiring of Pitt if a knowledge of Spanish signals was included in his lore of the sea, and if so, would he read the signals that the Garda Costa was flying. The young shipmaster confessed that it was not, and expressed the opinion that as a consequence they had but escaped the frying pan to fly into the fire. "Now here's a lack of faith in Madam Fortune," says Blood. "We'll just be dipping our flag in salute to them, implying that we've business elsewhere, and be off to attend to it. We look like honest Spaniards. Even through a telescope in this Spanish armor, Hagthorne and I must look like a pair of dons. Let's go and see how it's faring with the ingenious Easterling. I'm thinking the time has come to improve our acquaintance with him." The Garda Costa, if surprised at the unceremonious departure of the vessel she had assisted in the destruction of that pirate sloop, cannot have suspected her bona fides, either taking it for granted that she had business elsewhere, or else because too intent upon making prisoners of the crew of the Bonaventure, she made no attempt to follow. And so it fell out that some 2 hours later, Captain Easterling, waiting off the coast between Cape Raphael and Cape Engano, beheld to his stupefaction and horror the swift approach of Peter Blood's red ship. He had listened attentively and in uneasiness to the distant cannonade, but he had assumed its cessation to mean that the Cinco Llagas was taken. The sight now of that frigate, sailing briskly, jauntily, and undamaged, defined belief. What had happened to Chard? There was no sign of him upon the sea. Could he have blundered so badly as to have allowed Captain Blood to sink him? Speculation on this point was presently quenched by speculation of an infinitely graver character. What might be this damned Dr. Convict's present intention? If Easterling had been encased aboard him, he would have known no apprehension, for even his prize crew on the Santa Barbara outnumbered Blood's men by more than 2-1. But the crippled Santa Barbara could never be laid board and board with the Cinco Llagas unless Blood desired it. And if Blood met mischief as a result of what had happened with the Bonaventure, the Santa Barbara must lie at the mercy of his guns. The reflection, vexatious enough in itself, was maddeningly to Easterling when he considered what he carried under hatches. Fortune, it now began to seem, had not favored him at all. She had merely mocked him by allowing him to grasp something which he could not hold. But this was by no means the end of his vexation, for now, as if the circumstances in themselves had not been enough to enrage a man, his prize crew turned mutinous, led by a scoundrel named Gunning, a man almost as massive and ruthless as Easterling himself. They furiously blamed their captain and his excessive and improvident greed for the peril in which they found themselves, a peril of death or capture, embittered by the thought of the wealth they held. With such a prize in their hands, Easterling should have taken no risks. He should have kept the Bonaventure at hand for protection and paid no heed to the empty hulk of the Cinco Llagas. This they told him in terms of fiercest vituperation, whose very justice left him without answer other than insults, which he liberally supplied. Whilst they wrangled, the Cinco Llagas drew nearer, and now Easterling's quartermaster called his attention to the signals she was flying. He demanded the immediate presence aboard her of the commander of the Santa Barbara. Easterling was taken with panic. The high color receded from his cheeks. His heavy lips grew purple. He vowed that he would see Captain Blood in hell before he went. His men assured him that they would see him in hell, and shortly, if he did not go. Gunning reminded him that Blood could not possibly know what the Santa Barbara carried, and that before it should be possible to cozy him into allowing her to go her ways without further molestation. A gun thundered from the Santa Llagas to send a warning shot across the bows of the Santa Barbara. That was enough. Gunning thrust the quartermaster aside and himself seized the helm and put it over, so that the ship lay hove to as a first intimation of compliance. After that, the buccaneers launched the cockboat, and a half dozen of them swarmed down to man her, whilst almost at pistol point, Gunning compelled Captain Easterling to follow them. When presently he climbed into the waist of the Cinco Llagas, where she lay hove to, a cable's length away across the sunlit waters, there was hell in his eyes and terror in his soul. Straight and tall, in Spanish corselet and headpiece, the despised doctor stood forward to receive him. Behind him stood Hagthorne and a half a score of his followers. He seemed to smile. "At last, Captain, you stand where you have so long hoped to stand, on the deck of the Cinco Llagas." Easterling grunted ragefully. His great hands twitched as if he would have them at his Irish mocker's throat. Captain Blood continued to address him. "It's an ill thing, Captain, to attempt to grasp more than you can comfortably hold. You'll not be the first to find himself empty-handed as a consequence. It was a fine fast sailing sloop of yours, the Bonaventure. Ye should have been content. It's a pity she'll sail no more, for she's sunk, or will be entirely at high water." Abruptly, he asked, "How many hands are with you?" And he had to repeat the question before he was sullenly answered that 40 men remained aboard the Santa Barbara.
What boats does she carry?
3 with the cockboat.
That should be enough to accommodate your following. You'll order them into those boats at once if you value their lives, for in 15 minutes from now, I shall open fire on the ship and sink her. This because I can spare no men for a prize crew, nor can I leave her afloat to be repossessed by you and turned to further mischief. Easterling began a furious protest that was mixed with remonstrations of the peril to him and his of landing on Hispaniola. Blood chopped it short. You're receiving such mercy as you probably never showed to any whom ye compelled to surrender. Ye'll the best profit by my tenderness. If the Spaniards on Hispaniola spare you when you land there, you can get back to your hunting and buccaneering, for which you're better fitted than the sea. Away with you now. But Easterling did not at once depart. He stood with feet planted wide, swaying on his powerful legs, clenching and unclenching his hands. At last he took his decision.
Leave me that ship, and in Tortuga when I get there, I'll pay you 50,000 pieces of 8. It's better nor the empty satisfaction of turning us adrift.
Away with you, was all that Peter Blood answered him, his tone more peremptory.
100,000,
cried Easterling. Why not 1,000,000, wondered Blood. It's as easily promised, and the promise is easily broken. Oh, I'm like to take your word, Captain Easterling, as I'd like as I am to believe that ye command such a sum as 100,000 pieces of 8. Easterling's baleful eyes narrowed. Behind his black beard, his thick lips tightened. Almost they smiled. Since there was nothing to be done without disclosures, nothing should be done at all. Let Blood sink a treasure, which in any case must now be lost to Easterling. There was in the thought a certain bitter, negative satisfaction.
I pray that we meet again, Captain Blood,
he said falsely, grinning unctuously.
I'll have something to tell you that'll make you sorry for what you do now.
If we meet again, I've no doubt the occasion will be one for many regrets. Good day to you, Captain Easterling. You've just 15 minutes, you'll remember. Easterling sneered and shrugged and then abruptly turned and climbed down to the rocking boat that awaited him below. When he came to announce Blood's message to his buccaneers, they stormed and raged so fiercely at the prospect of thus being cheated of everything that they could be heard across the water aboard the Cinco Llagas, the faintly scornful amusement of Blood, who was far from suspecting the true reason of all this hubbub. He watched the lowering of the boats, and was thereafter amazed to see the decks of the Santa Barbara empty of that angry, vociferous mob. The buccaneers had gone below before leaving, each man intent upon taking as much of the treasure as he could carry upon his person. Captain Blood became impatient. Pass the word down to Ogley to put a shot into her forecastle. These rogues need quickening. The roar of the gun and the impact of the 24-pound shot as it smashed through the timbers of the high forward structure brought the buccaneers swarming upon deck again, and thence to the waiting boats with the speed of fear. Yet a certain order they preserved for their safety's sake, for in the sea that was running, the capsizing of a boat would have been an easy matter. They pushed off, their wet oars flashing in the sunlight, and they began to draw away towards the promontory not more than 2 miles to windward. Once they were clear, Blood gave the word to open fire, when Hagthorne clutched his arm. Wait, man, wait! Look! There's someone still aboard her. Surprised, Blood looked, first with his naked eye, then through his telescope. He beheld a bareheaded gentleman in corselet and thigh boots, who clearly was no buccaneer of the kind that sailed with Easterling, and who stood on the poop frantically waving a scarf. Blood was quick to guess his identity. It'll be one of the Spaniards who were aboard when Easterling took the ship and whose throat he forgot to cut. He ordered a boat to be launched and sent 6 men with Dyke, who had some knowledge of Spanish, to bring the Spaniard off. Don Aldefonso, who callously left the drowned in the doomed ship, had worked himself free of the thong that bound his wrists, stood in the forechains to await the coming of that boat. He was quivering with excitement at this deliverance of himself and the vessel in his charge with her precious freight, a deliverance which he regarded as little short of miraculous. For like the Guarda Costa, Don Aldefonso
even if he had not recognized the Spanish lines of this great ship, which had come so unexpectedly to the rescue, must have been relieved of all doubt by the flag of Spain, which had been allowed to remain floating on the masthead of the Cinco Llagas. So with speech blubbering eagerly out of him in that joyous excitement of his, the Spanish commander poured into the ears of Dyke, in the boat brought up alongside, the tale of what had happened to them and what they carried. Because of this, it was necessary that they should lend him a dozen men, so that with the six now under hatches on the Santa Barbara, he might bring his precious cargo safely into San Domingo. To Dyke, this was an amazing and exciting narrative, but he did not on that account lose grip of his self-possession. Least too much Spanish should betray him to Don Ildefonso. He took refuge in curtness. "Bueno," said he, "el informe my capitán." Under his breath, he ordered his men to push off and head back for the Cinco Llagas. When Blood heard the tale and had digested his amazement, "So this is what that rogue would have told me if ever we meet again. Fate, it's a satisfaction to be denied him." 10 minutes later, the Cinco Llagas lay bored and bored with the Santa Barbara. In the distance, Easterling and his men, observing the operation, rested on their oars to stare and mutter. They saw themselves cheated of even the meager satisfaction for which they had looked in the sinking of an unsuspected treasure. Easterling burst into fresh profanity.
"It'll be that damned Spaniard I forgot in the cabin who'll have blabbed of the gold. Oh, Steph, that is what comes of being soft-hearted. If only I'd cut his throat now."
Meanwhile, to Don Ildefonso, who had been able to make nothing of this boarding maneuver, Captain Blood, save for the light eyes in his bronze face, looking every inch a Spaniard, and delivering himself in the impeccable Castilian of which he was master, was offering explanations. He was unable to spare a crew to man the Santa Barbara, for his own following was insufficient, nor dare he leave her afloat, since in that case she would be repossessed by the abominable pirates whom he had constrained to abandon her. It remained, therefore, before scuttling her only to transship, the treasure with which Don Ildefonso informed him she was laden. At the same time, he would be happy to offer Del Ildefonso and his six surviving hands the hospitality of the Cinco Llagas as far as Tortuga. Or, if Don Ildefonso preferred it, as seemed probable, Captain Blood would seize a favorable moment for allowing them to take one of his boats and land themselves upon the coast of Hispaniola. Now, this speech was the most amazing thing that had yet happened to Don Ildefonso in that day of amazements.
"Tortuga?" he explained. "Tortuga? You sail to Tortuga, do you say? But what do you there? God's name, who are you then? What are you?"
"As for who I am called Peter Blood. As for what I am, faith, I scarce know myself."
"You are English,"
cried the Spaniard in sudden horror of partial understanding.
"Ah, no, that at least I am not."
Captain Blood drew himself up with great dignity. "I have the honor to be Irish."
"Ah, bah, Irish or English, it is all one."
"Indeed, and it is not. There's all a difference in the world between the two." The Spaniard looked at him with angry eyes. His face was livid, his mouth scornful.
"English or Irish, the truth is, you are just a cursed pirate."
Blood looked wistful. He fetched a sigh. "I'm afraid you were right," he admitted. "It is a thing I've sought to avoid, but what am I to do now? When fate thrusts itself upon me in this fashion and insists that I make so excellent a beginning."
You've been listening to The Treasure Ship, a Peter Blood adventure by Raphael Sabatini. Well, this has been Gremlin Time. This is the Over 40 Teenage Werewolf. We'll be back again next month. Stay tuned for the Tiki Cha-Cha Chingo, the Wiki, Wacky, Chachi. Well, you know the show. It'll be here at midnight. You're listening to Community Radio KBOO Portland. Stay tuned. I'll be back again next month. See you later.
Stay tuned for the Tiki Cha-Cha Club.
Ole, ole, it's go time!
In the tiki-tiki-tiki-tiki-tiki room, in the tiki-tiki-tiki-tiki-tiki room,
all the birds sing words and the flowers croon.
In the tiki-tiki-tiki-tiki-tiki room,
welcome to our tropical hideaway, you lucky people, you. If we weren't in the show starting right away, we'd be the audience too.
All together in the tiki-tiki-tiki-tiki-tiki room, in the tiki-tiki-tiki-tiki-tiki room,
all the birds sing words and the flowers croon.
In the tiki-tiki-tiki-tiki-tiki-tiki-room.
The birds
paradise is an elegant bird. It likes to be seen and it loves to be heard. Most little birdies will fly away, but the tiki room birds are here every day.
In the tiki, 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 tiki room. In the tiki, 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 tiki room.
All the birds sing words
and the flowers croon.
In the tiki, 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 tiki room.
A little louder.
In the tiki, 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 tiki room. In the tiki, 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 tiki room. All the birds sing words and the flowers croon. In the tiki, 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 tiki room.
Taking you to faraway places and bringing them home to you. This is the Tiki Cha-Cha Club, where the Cocktail Nation meets Exotica at the corner of Kalakaua Boulevard and Bourbon Street in a little Spanish village, a small discotheque on the Isle of Capri.
Another edition of that wacky cha-cha club. No, I mean it's the tacky cha-cha club as usual. It's not tacky at all. No, it's the wacky cha-cha. Yeah, that could be. Never know. No, it's the freaky cha-cha club. What? No, it's not that either. Oh, that's